Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is July 18th, 2019. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening for the second quarter wrap-up equity overview. This is the third part of the second quarter 2019 wrap-up. The last 2 weeks, we've been discussing news, trends, and stories with Dr. Farrell. We chew through the top trends and events. And now we look at how these trends and events convert into the global financial markets with a particular focus on the equity markets. Our outline this evening is in four parts. The first is I want to review performance. And for performance, I hope you've accessed the second quarter wrap-up web presentation. It has both the charts as of the end of the second quarter, so June 30, as well as the Rambus chartology. Rambus has once again done a great overview of the financial markets that he just has published over the last 5 days, and we have that up on the web presentation. I'm going to be using July 17th close numbers, so that's Wednesday, July 17th, yesterday. So number one, we're going to go through performance using the materials at the second quarter wrap-up web presentation. Then I want to talk about, can the bull trend in the equity markets hold? And in particular, can the Dow pass 30,000? Third, I want to talk about issues worth thinking about. There's a whole series of different issues that I want to bring to your attention. Then the fourth section is, what do you do? What does this mean to you? We're going to bring it down to some actions and then closing thoughts. So let's turn to our first section, performance. The U.S. equity markets have been in a rising trend since the bailout period in 2009, and we've been in a clear bull market from 2013 on. The U.S. equity markets are up over 30% since President Trump was elected, and it's clear that Trump and his administration see the stock market as a key performance metric. And with the Dow at 27,000, I think they're clearly shooting for a Dow of 30 to 35,000. So that's up another 10 to 30%. One of the most important questions we can all ask, is that possible? And if so, how is it possible? And that's one of the things I'm going to discuss tonight. Last year was a year when everything was down. We had an 18 to 20% consolidation into December from an October high. And we are now in the U.S. equity market slightly above those October highs. So we've reached a higher high, if you will. That was a nerve-wracking period for anyone tracking the equity markets. The hardest thing to call is when a bull market is over. Are we in a correction or is the bull over? And it was very hard to tell because an 18 to 20% down is a significant correction. One of the things that's clear, if you look at the history of the U.S. market, the winning strategy is a modified hold, which is you hold through a bull, but as soon as you turn to a bear, you exit and go to cash. And there's no doubt that a modified buy and hold on that model is more successful than a buy and hold. And the question is, of course, how do you know when you're in a bear? Because you can have to go pretty far down. And as I said, 18 to 20% is a pretty significant correction. The easiest way to get hurt as an investor is to bet against a bull trend. And if you have any question about that, go look at the Motif Investing summary in the charts at the web presentation. And what you can see is, of course, the bear funds are getting absolutely slaughtered now that the market has come back and reached new highs. I put a chart in the commentary for this Solari report that shows the U.S. markets versus the global equities and bonds, and it's clear that the U.S. equity market has significantly outperformed global equities, both European and emerging markets and Asian markets, since the fiscal crisis. I tend to believe it required 9/11 and the global war on terror to get that accomplished, and the question is, what's going to keep it going? As you can see from looking at the chart, that significant outperformance since the Trump election has continued and even widened, both with the general market. If you look at the NASDAQ and the tech sector, they're clearly the strongest performer. Rambus always does a good job of pointing out that we're in a bull trend. And he says this time again, the bottom line is that the trend is your friend until you see a confirmed reversal pattern. And that's what we haven't gotten. We haven't gotten a confirmed reversal pattern. It's interesting, Rambus has done an excellent job of affirming the bull in the face of many angry gold bugs who don't want to hear that the stock market is doing well and is expected to do well. There are five sections to his chartology this time. The first is U.S. equities. Then the second is looking at the U.S. equity market by sector. Then world equities. Then precious metals. And then currencies. So let's walk through each one of them. So starting with U.S. equities, the S&P now up 20.24% for the year, with the NASDAQ running about 400 basis points ahead of the S&P. And the home builders doing very well. Home builders up 31%, benefiting from the central bank's pivot from their sound money policy last year. That didn't last long. So clearly, equity is significantly outperforming fixed income, although fixed income is benefiting also from the pivot to lower interest rates with prices up. So the long treasury ETF up 10%, so half of what the S&P is up. And then the intermediate up 6.35, intermediate treasuries, bond aggregate up almost 6%, and junk flying at 10.6%. Clearly, everybody feels risk on with the central banks going so far to improve everything. I put a quote up in the commentary from Jeff Gunlatch, who's the head of Double Line. Quote, gold is making money, Bitcoin is making money, stocks are making money, bonds are making money. I'd rather own gold than Bitcoin. Now, if you look at the recent turn in Bitcoin, Bitcoin is not making money, but certainly everything else is. And that's important because last year, everything across the board at the end of the year had lost money. So as I said, it's risk on. Let's turn to U.S. equity by sectors. What you can see is some of the sectors are really being hurt, including the banks are hurt by the change in Fed policies. So they're getting less money. So rising interest rates is going to make the banks or help bank profitability. Instead, the banks are working hard to lower the government cost of capital at the expense of their earnings. And if you look at how dependent they are on the federal credit and government money, you can see why they would easily defer to keep the treasury bond market going. But it's certainly making life difficult for the European banks because the European banks didn't get the extent of the bailouts that the U.S. banks did. Fundamentals, I wanted to point out that agriculture and transportation are clearly showing signs of a recession. Reports, lots of trucking companies reporting much slower volumes, and clearly the agriculture sector in the heartland is really reeling from the problems with flooding and the weather. Well, challenges with the harvest can translate into much lower GMPs. It's hard to tell how it translates into the corporate stock market. My big concern about the agriculture is we're watching a lot of disaster capitalism where the big corporations are going to pick up lots of land in the heartland for cheap. So it doesn't necessarily have to be bad for the stock markets. But as you can see by the sectors, there's pain. Not as much pain as I think there is on Main Street, because more and more what we're watching is, of course, a giant sucking sound of GNP out of the smaller companies in Main Street into the big companies. World equities, the VGK, the European ETF, now up 14.81%, not as good as the U.S. markets, but clearly way ahead of fixed income. Germany up 11.45%, the developed markets up almost 14%. China only up 9%. That's the trade war has clearly cost China something, and that's large caps. Small caps up 12%. Emerging market up 10.46%. And one of the things we see is a constant reminder is that Asia is converging with the developed world, but the emerging markets are not. And so even though China is slowing, it's still Asia that is moving towards the convergence with the per capita incomes in the West. And of course, that makes the fight over the Silk Road that much more important. Precious metals are a real bright spot. Gold is now up 11% for the year, and silver now in the black, up almost 3% for the year. Rambus is clearly calling for the gold bull to return. And what he says is, quote, after almost 8 years of corrective action in the precious metals complex, it looks like this sector is ready to resume its 2000 bull market once more by the side of the head and shoulder consolidation pattern that gold has built out since 2013. That alone tells us to expect a multi-year rally at a minimum. So Rambus is saying very good news for gold, and there's no doubt gold appears to be one of the bright spots for 2019. If you look at currencies, the message is most currencies are flat or down, and the U.S. dollar continues in its upward trend. Bad news for exporters in the United States, but the dollar continues to be strong. Now, the U.S. dollar index is only up 1.36% for the year. I think the most unnerving thing about global stock markets, and particularly the U.S. stock market, is when you realize the extent to which the stock market is the beneficiary of government fiscal largesse and central bank monetary largesse. It's almost, does it really take this much steroids to keep the stock market going? When you add FASB 56 to the mix, it gets really scary, because the question when you look at U.S. stock market is, how much of the increase and the outperformance of U.S. stock market, how much of that is simply largesse through the government back door, whether it's money or assets or government contracts or servicing contracts for the banks? So there's a major support of the U.S. government to help the U.S. stock markets outperform. And the question is, what kind of steroids do you need to keep that going? It's one of the reasons I'm so worried about federal asset stripping. And of course, the financial question is, if you're a pension fund, are your pension fund stocks benefiting from the offset of the assets disappearing from your government? And I think the question moving forward is, are the assets being shifted away from the liabilities? And then what happens to the liabilities? There are going to be significant winners and losers in this process. So that's the overview. 2019, everything making money. After 2018, everything losing money. But we seem to have recovered from the correction at the end of last year, and we're back in an upward trend in a bull market. Okay, so let's turn to the second section. Can the Dow pass 30,000? In the 2014 annual wrap-up, I did a presentation called Planet Equity. And I basically said, okay, we've had the bailouts. We've exploded the sovereign debt around the world. There are three things we can do. We can write down the debt, we can write up the equity, or we can go to war, or some combination of all three. But it didn't take much to ascertain that there would be a clear preference in the leadership to writing the equity up, if at all possible. I think if you think of the planet as a house, and you've got a mortgage and the equity's underwater, it doesn't take a genius to figure out anything we can do to make the equity go up, we will. And so I think part of the central bank's policy has been to print money and make sure that money can channel into the stock market as opposed to channel into hyperinflation on Wall Street. Part of this process is securitizing everything. So we're going through a period where at the turn of the century, we had essentially the developed world had equity markets, but we're in the process of literally securitizing everything planet-wide and bringing it into the stock market. And it's one of the reasons the stock market has grown significantly in terms of total market cap. And as I pointed out in the megacities wrap-up, we're also bringing in real estate globally. And so whether you're bringing in equity globally or real estate globally, and then, of course, developing far more venture in the emerging and frontier markets, you're giving much more importance to the equity markets, and you're growing the equity markets worldwide. And I see that trend as just very deep and very important and continuing and part of technocracy. This is all part of the technocracy that we discussed with Patrick Wood. It's clear when you listen to Trump and the government officials that they see the stock market as being an unbelievably important performance metric. And they're talking about a Dow at 30 or 35,000. Now, it's interesting, if you look at Trump and his Secretary of Treasury, they're uniquely qualified to do this. They're New Yorkers. Mnuchin's father was a critical part of building the Goldman Equities desk when I was on Wall Street, widely considered to be the most capable and able equities desk on the street. And Mnuchin is Yale and Skull and Bones. So you basically got some pretty significant equity players in this administration. And you've, you know, add Wilbur Ross, and you've got basically a workout guy and private equity guy, very much in the Rothschild tradition. Anyway, so how do you achieve higher equity prices? If your goal is to make a Dow of 30 to 35,000, how do you do it? Well, it's very simple. You have to either increase earnings, or you have to add more assets into the market at attractive PEs, either your current PE or higher PE, or you have to raise the price earnings ratio, which means lower the cost of capital. It's why interest rates and low interest rates are so important, and why you've seen Trump bashing Powell and feeling switch hit by the tough money policies of 2018. Anyway, so bashing the central banks and getting them to lower interest rates is important. So unfortunately, I think to make 30 to 35,000, you're going to need a lot of what I would describe as visible and invisible violence, whether it's legal violence, financial violence, physical violence, war, electromagnetic violence. So there are 13 sort of, I made a list of the 13 factors that could be used to push the stock market higher, and I want to take a look at them. One of the most important, interestingly enough, I think, is 5G, because 5G creates the train tracks for much greater invisible and invasive high-speed access and communications that will combine AI, virtual reality, entrainment, entertainment. It's the train tracks by which you do significant increases in the centralization of earnings into publicly traded corporations, and increase their share of global income. So it's not just in the developed markets, it's globally. And it's one of the reasons that the war with Huawei and the Chinese over who's going to be supreme in 5G is so significant. So if you look at the Anglo-American Alliance, which is sort of the Brits, the Israelis, the U.S., this is the train tracks for scarfing up global income. And whether it's making sure you control on the Silk Road or making sure you control on the digital highway, this is a major, major power point. And I think it's one of the reasons you see such a significant emphasis on this by the administration. It's part and parcel of getting the Dow to 35,000. So number one, I think, is 5G. Number two is continued fiscal and monetary steroids. Now, there's no doubt that the fiscal and monetary steroids so far in the Trump administration have been very significant. We see both the ECB and the Fed policy, one of continued low interest rates and bond buying. FASB 56 is the mother of all steroids creator. So I think you're seeing a combination of things, because you're ramping down on a lot of the funny business. When you close out groups like the Clinton Foundation and Epstein, you're closing out a lot of waste in the system. And FASB 56 is going to be used to tighten up the system dramatically. But there's no doubt it gives you the ability to move massive amounts of assets into the private side from the government, as well as relieve all sorts of requirements by related corporations for SEC compliance, etc. Keeping gold prices lower than where they would be if you had a free market in gold is part of maintaining the fiscal and monetary steroids. You want to be able to print as much money through the central banks without giving away that the monetary policy is as liberal as it is. If you listen to Rob Kirby's latest interviews with Greg Hunter, he talks a lot about using the $21 trillion and the missing money to launder money out into the economy without it being apparent that the monetary policy is extraordinarily loosened as it is. Part of these steroids is running an enormous differential in the cost of capital between insiders and outsiders. So while you and I are paying 24% on our credit card, you know, the insiders are basically getting capital at 0% and even at negative rates at this point. The negative interest rate policies are pretty astonishing. We now have over $13 trillion of global sovereign bonds with negative yields. It's a direct reflection of the sub-zero short-term interest rates that we're seeing from the ECB and some of the other central banks, including in Europe, as well as the Bank of Japan. It's one of the reasons Lagarde, the new head of the ECB, is talking about a cashless society. It's just another way of harvesting us. But so we're talking about extraordinary fiscal and monetary policy steroids. And the question is, can they keep it going? How do they keep it going? If you look at the current chart of the negative interest rate bonds, it's literally headed up in a straight line, and you kind of wonder, how long can this last? Okay, three is visible and invisible military force. I think there's a lot of what I would describe as disaster capitalism and weather warfare going on. I also think big investments in space that show up in earnings but don't necessarily get explained in the annual report. And of course, the big fight here is control of the Silk Road. If you look at what's happened over the last month, I think there is a very significant new push to use economic sanctions and pressure in the oil markets. You know, we see a lot of the Navy, U.S. and British Navy, now sailing into the Straits of Hormuz. So I think there's an incredible push to basically collapse Iran without a land war. But it shows you the importance of controlling on the Silk Road. I'll talk a little bit about more in money and markets this week. We have a new bill, the U.S.-Israeli Cooperation Enhancement and Regional Security Act. Very bad news, because you see more and more push for combined both military and cybersecurity effort with Israel. And I think it's sacrificing sovereignty to get more steroids is never a good plan, in my view. Number four, that brings us to IT, cyber warfare, and surveillance capitalism. I think the surveillance capitalism in the United States is off the charts, and 5G is just going to make it worse. But there's no doubt it can create a lot more centralization of income into publicly traded corporations. Number five, deregulation. Lowering regulation lowers costs, increases all sorts of opportunities. And I think the Trump administration is clearly committed to significant deregulation. Some of that I support because it's a reversal of technocracy. Number six, piratization. And as I keep saying on every Solari report for the last 2 years, as soon as they allocate the JEDI contract, apparently, which is said to be this coming month in August 2019, I think the speed at which privatization can happen will accelerate. And my concern is it's not going to be privatization, it's going to be piratization. And the question is, how aggressive will the Trump administration be? Because the potential to dramatically reduce government employment is there. The questions are, what are the politics of significantly increasing or decreasing government employment, thereby potentially increasing unemployment? Will the private sector be able to pick those people up? Number seven, global securitization of equity and real estate. There's no doubt if you are the U.S. markets and you're trading at a very high P.E., and you can bring in lots of assets globally because you have such a low cost of capital, and you can bring them into those publicly traded platforms. That's gonna significantly expand your market cap. Lowering taxes, of course, has done a lot to support the U.S. equity market. So we saw the 2018 tax changes. We see the president now trying to figure out whether or not he can index capital gains taxes for inflation. if that is instituted by regulation, and I would be amazed if Congress allowed that to happen, but if it did, you're watching a very different treatment of the wealthy to protect them against inflation versus the middle class and poor. Opportunity zones is another example of lowering taxes. So lowering taxes is a big one, and the question is how much more of that can occur globally in the face of very significant outstanding sovereign bonds. There's no doubt one of the push for lower and negative interest rates is to protect the governments from having to dig deeper for taxes to keep their debt positions serviced. Number nine, new technology. New technology continues to lead the market. So if you look at the U.S. markets, the NASDAQ continuing to perform way ahead of the S&P, and there's no doubt one of the big opportunities for many companies is can they bring new technology and use it to create new products or to lower expenses. One of the big wild cards to me, certainly not an issue in 2019, but it's coming, is when will we start to use breakthrough energy technology to significantly lower energy prices? And as you can see, one of the sectors really trading down. Take a look at the motif chart in the charts at the web presentation. You can see shale is just getting clobbered, and the fossil fuel companies getting clobbered in the equity mix. And that's clearly a signal that the new energy technology is coming. Number 10, adding 4 billion people to the internet. There's nothing like adding 4 billion customers. if you look at the at 9/11, as of the date of 9/11, when the war on terror launched the sort of global buyout by the unipolar model, we had 8 to 9% of the population on the internet. Today, we have 50% on the internet, and it's growing to 100%. When it hits 100%, we will have added between now and then another 4 billion people on the internet. And it's one of the reasons why very important is number 11, lower transaction costs. If the 4 billion that we're going to add have to pay the same kind of transaction costs that you and I are paying on PayPal or our Visa, it ain't going to work. So it's one of the reasons you see a push for cryptocurrencies is to find a way to significantly lower transaction costs. But as those lower transaction costs combine with 4 billion people being added onto the internet, and you combine that with 5G and the Internet of Things, you're talking about explosive change and explosive opportunity for many, many economic players. Finally, our old friend, which we talked about in the Asian consumer, the rise of the Asian consumer last year's second quarter wrap-up, the per capita income of Asia continues to converge with the West, and that's very significant growth in consumer and other markets. And it's, again, one of the reasons why control on the Silk Road is so important. And then finally, 13, keeping inflation rates low. Can they continue to channel enormous fiscal and monetary largesse into asset prices and the global stock markets, and building out the global stock markets instead of letting hyperinflation happen on Main Street? If you look at the Chapwood Index, and I encourage everybody who hasn't to please go look at chapwoodindex.com, Main Street has experienced about a 50% increase in household good prices in the last 5 years. It's running at about anywhere from 8 to 13%, depending on where you are, but let's just pick an average of 10%. That's not a hyperinflation, but it's pretty significant inflation if your income is flat or only going up at 2%. It's the squeeze of the slow burn, and there's no doubt it's accelerating. But if you can keep the largesse of fiscal and monetary policy flowing into asset prices as opposed to hyperinflation, then you can continue to play this game. So many different ways and strategies to keep the stock markets headed higher. And I don't underestimate the ability of the Trump administration to take the lead on doing that. Now, what's the alternative scenario? go back and look at the Rambus charts, and what you can see is the rise of the sort of long-term trends up and the bull, particularly since 2013, very much relates to what happened after 9/11, the build-out of a much more powerful national security state and a global war on terror. You move our armies globally, you have $17 trillion in missing money subsequent to that date, so $21 trillion total. You have massive infusions to a variety of private players from the bailouts. So between the bailouts delivering trillions and the missing money delivering trillions and the shift of armies globally and rendition centers globally, you're talking about massive steroids to build out the unipolar model. And the reality is the unipolar model could unwind in some very ugly ways. And no doubt about it, what we're seeing global slowdown in a variety of areas. So we could simply have a recession, but we could also have the unipolar model unwind in an ugly way. I think it's one of the reasons you're seeing such a ferocious push on Iran and the control of the Silk Road. But whether recession or an unwinding, we could see the equity markets really take a nosedive. And that's part of the challenge of looking at this environment, because you're talking about an enormous swing. Do we go up another 10 to 30% as the Trump administration, I believe, is going to try and do? Or do we go down 25 to 50% if recession or unwind of the unipolar model happens? My handicap today is I give it about 80% chance we make the 10 to 30% up, very much driven by the advantages of new technology, or 20% chance we hit a 25 to 50% down in the markets and have a stagflation picture. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you look at the kind of steroids that have to be brought to bear to get another 10 to 30%, I for one would prefer the 25 to 50% down. I just think the level of violence and steroids that are going to happen on the 10 to 30% up, I'd rather do without. Thank you very much. So I don't think that a strong stock market necessarily translates into a wonderful life for people. If anything, we're talking about more technocracy, more central control, more invasive AI and surveillance capitalism. So I'm not necessarily looking forward to a higher stock market. As Rambus always says, this is the most hated bull market in history. But I think one of the reasons it's the most hated bull market in history is if you look at some of the things that are being done to make the earnings estimates, we're driving corporate earnings up in a way which is lowering the quality of the civilization and the quality of the overall economy. Okay, so let's turn to some issues that I want to point out. It's a lot of things that I think give you a better picture of what's happening. One is, if you look at the very big picture on investment, we kind of are having a competition between our vision of peak resources and peak everything and growing populations and environmental deterioration. So all the challenges that face us in terms of the sustainability of the model of how we manage our resources on planet Earth versus the blessings of new technology and human innovation and what they make possible. So the question is, can we solve the problems before us, or will the problems overwhelm and outrace us? Now, it's interesting, whenever I hear people talk about the end of the planet and the planet's dying and this is going wrong and that's going wrong, one of the things I always notice is if you look at the top investors, they're working hard to print money and buy up everything. So the bad guys clearly believe in the future, and sometimes you wonder if their negativity, all the negativity being pushed, isn't to lower the prices so they can scarf up everything. I mentioned earlier, but I want to underscore again, if you take a look, keep an eye on the extent of the negative interest rates, because it really speaks to the extraordinary steroids that are being used to keep the economy pumping along. Brexit is coming. Boris Johnson will probably win the elections. We should know in 4 days from now what's going to happen in the Conservative Party elections. And if Johnson wins, the tug of war will, can they do a hard Brexit? But Brexit is coming, and that's a big event for the European Union to digest. The trade war continues with China, and I think it's going to continue to be one of tension. China is also struggling with high debt loads and an aging population. So I just continue to see that to be a weight that could spin out of control. Iran, another hot spot. The Anglo-American alliance must dominate the Silk Road if they're going to keep their model together. And again, if that model unwinds, watch markets go in a different direction in a big way. FASB 56 is a very major issue because we're talking about the biggest securities issuer in the world and the biggest government in the world, essentially leaving accounting behind. So the U.S. government financial statements basically have become meaningless. And unfortunately, if you look at how FASB 56 combines with national security law, that means all the large defense contractors and all the large banks also have left accounting behind, and their financial statements are meaningless, which means the majority of the U.S. securities market has gone dark. So we really are in never, never land. And so the question becomes, how do we discern economically what the real flow of resources are? And it's something I've written a lot about, and it was one of the reasons we made such an effort to get a major report in the annual wrap-up, and those two volumes have just mailed to everybody who's ordered hard copies. We have volume one on back order, but I would strongly recommend you read it because our coverage of the equity markets is now going to have to operate with very, very little accounting, and it's scary. I wanted to bring up Bayer, which purchased Monsanto. It's one of those stocks that shows you what a risky environment it is for even the corporate management today. We have Bayer now down more than 50% from its high in 2014. They can thank the purchase of Monsanto for that. And it makes you wonder who's going to pick up all that land in the heartland. Buybacks have been a major contributor to propping up the market. And one of the ways that the corporate buyouts have occurred is corporations taking advantage of the low interest rates to borrow lots of money and then using that money to buy up their shares. And it's levering up their balance sheet tremendously. We're coming into a period where we have very significant corporate maturities next year, the year after, and in combination with the fight in the sovereign bond market for liquidity, the question is, you know, how is corporate America going to handle those maturities? How are they going to get the refinancing done? And what is that going to mean to the stock market? It certainly means they can't have the kind of buybacks that they've had to prop up the market. And so the corporate debt picture is a very negative one potentially for the stock market. Pension funds. The pension fund crisis in the United States is coming to a head. There's no doubt that one of the reasons the administration wants strong equity prices is to help prop up the pension funds. We're seeing a move to bail out the union plans, the multiple employer plans. Don't be surprised if you see more proposals for bailing out the pension funds. And given the bailouts and the missing money, I don't see how politicians can get out of that. We're watching also new efforts to encourage more 401k funding. Too little, too late. But interestingly enough, there seems to be an effort to encourage place-based 401ks by small business. We'll see if that's something that helps encourage local investment. More on that later. When I was in Thailand in May, one of the things I saw was really a remarkable development over the last 20 years in the infrastructure, in the managerial infrastructure in Asia. So I'll never forget being in China in 1996. I was going to negotiate some database development deals with Chinese universities in Beijing and Shanghai. And basically, China was having to import managers from Hong Kong and Singapore. They just didn't have the managerial infrastructure. But if you see what they've accomplished in the last several decades, it's pretty extraordinary. And so we're now seeing in 25 years a wealth of entrepreneurial and managerial talent. And as a result, you're seeing throughout Asia the building of very significant companies that have the governance and management to really play on a global stage. It's very encouraging. It's one of the good things that are happening. Because I'm a great believer that the way to deal with investment in this environment is to focus on finding the good companies wherever they are. And we'll talk about that in a second. Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies I continue to see the cryptocurrency space to be a niche. If you look at the market capitalization of Bitcoin, it's about $200 billion. It's probably dropped through that with the recent price drops. In the scheme of the financial markets, it's tiny. So I see this market as continuing to prototype for the day when the central banks will essentially take it over. But it's a way for now to help keep retail out of gold and keep the gold prices suppressed. And I had thought we were in a new pump on Bitcoin. It ran up to over 12,000. It's now running back down below 8,000. So we appear to be in a little bit of a dump. And the question is, will they continue to pump it up this fall? Given the rise in the gold price, I expect to see a lot more pump on Bitcoin. But again, whenever you have anything this manipulated, anything can happen. Private equity. We continue to watch a lot of the best investment opportunities screamed out of the market with private equity, and it's a real concern because you're seeing float between the buybacks and the creaming of private equity and leveraged buyout firms. You're continuing to see a lot of the best yields creamed out of the market. Society is well served by broad liquid markets, and if you end up with a hierarchy of sort of aristocracies that can skim off the best performances and deals, you kill the goose that laid the golden egg. We're seeing a significant increase in venture capital. Let me just read some of my notes. Venture capital funding in the U.S. reached its highest level since the turn of the millennium. U.S. venture funding climbed to $55 billion in the first 6 months of 2019. Internet companies profited most from the surge in VC funding, drawing a total of $22.6 billion in the first half of 2019. Healthcare and mobile telecommunications startups were the other main beneficiaries, receiving $8.8 and $5.9 billion in venture capital. Meanwhile, the number of unicorns, i.e. VC-backed companies valued at $1 billion, reached a new high. According to blah, blah, the U.S. unicorn population climbed to 167 by the end of second quarter, despite several large-scale exit in recent months. So clearly, if you look at the venture part and the private equity market, things seem to be thriving. And new technology, big part of that. And a strong NASDAQ is going to continue to encourage that. Finally, ESG, which stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. I'm going to be talking about that more in the first quarter theme, which we'll publish next week. But the ESG trend just continues to be strong. And my question, of course, is that going to contribute to real change, or is it just going to be used to implement technocracy? So as you can see, many interesting things going on in the markets, and we see a lot of very positive trends and a lot of very negative. And it's always the question of, you know, the bulls and the bears, who's going to win out. Okay, number four, what do you do? What does this all mean to you? The likely scenario is we're going to continue to see high inflation. So I say that 50% increase in household goods over a five-year period is high inflation. I don't care what anybody says. Yes, it's not hyperinflation, but to me, it's very significant. And it's going to combine with low yields on fixed income. So if in 1990, you could get 8% on a bank CD, today, you're going to get almost nothing. So we're going to continue to live with our household goods going up, 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 but very difficult time trying to get any kind of yield on our savings. I think lawlessness and corruption is, if anything, going to continue. We're going to see significant pain in the heartland, whether in the farming sector or small business. Part of it is when you get these kinds of government steroid, they go to the insiders more than to the outsiders. And I think surveillance capitalism is going to make it much more difficult for the small companies to compete. So it's very important, if you have your own business, to understand what 5G potentially could mean to you. It means your competitors are scarfing up all your information and data as we speak. I see a lot of people in America on a treadmill of mind control, bad food, bad water, bad media, bad healthcare, and the people who are succeeding are getting off the treadmill. And I think it's incredibly important to get off that treadmill. But there's no doubt that a lot of the people in the Main Street economy are not going to make it. So if we look at our 80-20 scenario, let's say we have an 80% chance of the Dow going up another 10 to 30% and 20% chance it goes down 50% if and when the unipolar model unwinds. This is an environment where you want to be in real things. There's no doubt about it that the fiscal and monetary largesse means that you need to protect yourself from inflation. Now, what does that mean? It means tangibles. It means good companies that have endurance, and more than anything in this environment, given what's coming up with the corporate rollovers and maturities and debt, you want good companies with endurance and low debt. They have the capacity to either grow dividends or they have the capacity to successfully apply new technology in a way that's going to produce capital gains. And I think that's the area where you're going to experience the best return. There are lots of those companies around. One of the big challenges for investors is there are a lot of these great companies in Europe that are in a market which is underperforming the U.S. market. And to me, they represent a great investment, but there's no reason to believe that the European markets won't continue to underperform. And so you have to be able to break away from the index and sort of index tracking if you're going to invest in them. But my clear strategy is find the great companies. Find the great companies who have products that can endure through this environment. Find the great companies that, you know, don't have highly leveraged balance sheets, and be a company picker. Don't worry about, you know, U.S. versus European versus emerging markets. Find the great companies and stick with them. One of the issues is, if you are going to be in the equity markets, are you going to use hedges or not? And it really comes down to your capacity to live with significant volatility. There's no doubt if you've used hedges over the last 5 years, you've given up a lot of return. The hedges have been expensive. The reality is, if you can't stand the volatility, we still run a risk in an 80-20 scenario where we could be down significantly. So you have to be willing to pick those great companies and live through the downs, which if you're buying companies that can produce a real dividend or produce real capital gains, it's not a problem, but you just have to be willing to break mentally from the index and just stick with the long-term buy and hold strategy. Precious metals, I agree with Rambus. We look significantly better than we did a year ago, and it looks like we've returned to the bull, and there's no doubt about it. Precious metals in this environment are a solid tangible, and the question is, can you buy them in a way that you have a low cost of carry? Very, very important. Real estate, income producing or food producing real estate, to me is a great investment. Whoever is picking up all that land in the heartland is going to come out smelling like a rose in 20 years. So, but you've got to make sure it's income producing. The real estate can be the gift that gives on giving. I'll never forget when I was FHA commissioner, I found a nursing home in our portfolio where we had foreclosed on the mortgage at $8 million. It was an $8 million mortgage. And by the time I found it, we'd spent $20 million keeping the nursing home funded. So just make sure you're picking up something that is very significantly income producing or food producing. Finally, remember the emerging markets outside of Asia are not converging with the developed markets. And so the developed markets have been much more attractive than the emerging markets. But as I said, when I was out in Thailand, you still see individual companies that just are doing very exciting things. So I think in the emerging markets, you've got to be very careful about the companies you underwrite, particularly outside of Asia. There's no doubt if I won the lottery today, I'd be putting a significant investment into equities, but I'd be looking for global excellence, and I'd be very, very picky about the quality of management and governance, very picky. Fixed income, I just think they're very significant credit quality issues. We see a lot of managers looking for yield going to emerging market sovereign bonds, and I'm not saying they're not opportunities there, but I just think if you're going to take that kind of risk, I'd rather be in excellent high-quality companies. We now see Lagarde talking about doing away with cash. If you're in negative interest rates, it's just another way to harvest people. Jeff Gundlach thinks we're going back to 5 to 6% interest rates because there's going to be so much pressure on the corporate refinancings. I just don't see it. I never underestimate the ability of the central banks to push yields down in this environment. And if you look at the dependency of government on low interest rate financing, I just think whether it's low yields or serious credit quality, the fixed income market, to me, the long-term bull market is over. So I could get interested again at a very high quality municipal yielding 5%. But before then, I want to stick with tangibles. I just don't see the fixed income markets as having any opportunity. If I was going to have money in fixed income, I'd much rather get cash sitting in a safe deposit bank or a safe, which is, again, why Lagarde is talking about getting rid of cash. Anyway, what can you do to minimize your need for yield? Because this is an environment, if you look at what you're going to have to do to earn yield in the market other than through capital gains, it's much easier to invest money in a way that lowers your expenses. So, you know, buy your own land, get your own well, grow your own food, move to an area with significantly lower taxes. If you're in a high tax area, do anything you can to get out. I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal about couples who've bought a yacht and are sort of sailing around. It's one way to avoid jurisdictional issues. Pay off your debt. This is not an environment to have fixed payments. And please make as much, be very liberal and be a spendthrift when it comes to investing money on your nutrition and health. And again, anything you can do to minimize risk by getting institutions and people who have low or no integrity out of your life. I'm always shocked with more and more when I talk to a subscriber and I find out that they're still banking with one of the large banks and they tell me, my account is unimportant, I'm unimportant. If you think you're unimportant, you haven't heard a word I've said about, because you're letting basically transnational organized crime into your data flows, you know, and energetically you're bringing them in. So whether you're bringing them into your data or you're bringing them into your energy, it's very, very dangerous. And I think with 5G, it's even going to get more dangerous. So anything you can do as the environment is deflating incomes, anything you can do to deflate your expenses and invest to deflate your expenses, do it yourself in this environment is an absolutely outstanding way to go. And anything you can do to increase your learning metabolism, to learn how to do more yourself is absolutely a way to go. Keep it in the family. So look for opportunities. I saw one father not that long ago and he said, you know, I took your advice and I refinanced all 4 kids out of their mortgages and I can't say I'm getting a great yield, but I sleep at night. So back to family. So a few closing thoughts. I think there is an extraordinary amount of opportunity in this environment, but it's offset with steadily rising risk. And it's important, if you're going to achieve good returns in this environment, you have to invest as much if not more time, in what I call predator evasion and risk management, as in finding opportunities. And it's important not to let the risk management and predator evasion get you overwhelmed so that you don't go looking for those opportunities, because they're really there. But there's no doubt change is accelerating, and the way to surf that change is to keep looking and finding those opportunities. So just keep on learning. Whatever you do, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Thank you.